around issues of the crises, interlocking crises in the areas of food and water and climate chaos and destabilization, in waste and toxics, and in the sort of foundational crisis of the increasing like denigration of biological and cultural diversity upon which like our whole fabrics of human and other, you know, all species survival rests. So the capitalist system, like we believe that the system can't go on much longer if humans are to survive as a species, which in some ways is a good, like the fact that we're being forced into a crisis of capitalism is hopefully, if we can seize the moment, a positive thing in some ways, an opportunity for us. And history shows that who has power in these moments is really key. The nature of the economic and social reorganization is going to depend entirely because the world progresses in some way, right? We've seen that systems have gotten increasingly more and more polarized and more unjust. So this is why we at Movement Generation, and I think probably all of you, right, believe that it's really critical that a forward-looking and prepared social movement left provide key leadership in this period of transition. And so Movement Generation sees cultivating ecological literacy as a central strategic and actually moral priority for the social movement left, and that's what we're working to do, starting with ourselves. So this is the moment, we think, where we can connect across issues and across constituencies, not to drop any of those, right? Not to drop the important work that folks are doing around stopping gentrification and fighting for immigrant rights, but actually to add, I just got louder, I keep. But just to add a key lens that can help us provide a systemic analysis and the transformative vision that we believe the left and the left rooted in social movements and grassroots forces can provide and must provide. We did a retreat 2 weeks ago and we got these beautiful visuals, so I'm gonna take advantage. We're working basically to build movement and community in sort of three key areas. Working to build communities of resilience and resistance that are also engaged in a process of reimagining our worlds. On the first level, we run an Earth Skills track, and we're working with organizations like Bay Localize. We partner really closely with the Occidental Arts and Ecology Center up in Sonoma. It's where we run almost all of our retreats and strategy spaces. But more importantly, here in the Bay Area, we're working to sort of foster communities' resilience by building these kinds of hard skills around local food production, rainwater catchment, gray water systems, and local decentralized energy creation, right? So sort of helping to create spaces where communities are developing the resources to weather the storm in a very literal sense, right? Meanwhile, we're also working to change the systems, right? So building local and regional power, which is where we think it's most important and where we actually have the most ability, right, to make change and to build our power through campaigns, through policy work, and increasingly to stepping up to actually prepare to govern. So building power is the second area. And then reimagining, which we think is really about writing the new narrative, what we're calling kind of a new transformative narrative, right, that replaces the kinds of what are now called the common sense values of like you have to have a wage job in order to get your needs met, you got to get mine. And so we're trying to move from values like get mine to share ours, right? And in writing this kind of narrative, we're hoping, and not just us, but with, you know, thousands of people around the country and around the world, right, that we're hoping to help shift ourselves and others from the role of consumers, which is the role that we're often forced to play, to the role of actors, right? And the idea is to win and create local, living, participatory economies and to reclaim the commons. So we're working to transform the system that we have today, right, which is rooted in deep inequality and exploitation and oppression, to one that's based on values of sovereignty and self-determination, to a world where many worlds fit, right, as the Zapatistas say, to valuing progress and wellness over growth, and to understanding the places in which we live, to having a sense of real ecological literacy. So how we work. So Movement Generation works to do this by working with individual organizers and activists to integrate, well, first of all, to develop their own sense of ecological literacy, and then secondly, to start to integrate that into their organizations and their work. So again, not stopping the work that they're doing around housing justice or workers' rights, for example, but integrating an ecological analysis and an understanding of the current landscape as well as the possibilities for transforming their own work. And then to bring this analysis into their leadership that they're providing to alliances that are both within their sectors, but then also working across sectors and across movements. And you know, the ultimate goal, right, in the social forum is, I think, a place where we're really building towards this, is like to inspire a new politic that helps to unite us across movements in this critical moment of transition, to be building communities of resistance and resilience that are reimagining and that are building, you know, across sectors, across movements together, so that we can actually be the kind of force that we feel in our bodies, that we feel so excited about participating in these spaces, you know, for. So two concrete examples of how this is playing out. So the first is POWER, People Organized to Win Employment Rights. So folks know of POWER in San Francisco, right? So POWER organizes in the Bayview, Hunters Point District, and then in the Mission District. Somebody, I don't know if folks are placed there, maybe even. Alicia Garza came through one of our series of retreats last year, and came back and went back to the organization, and they did sort of an environmental audit internally, and started with changing some of their practices around composting and recycling. They got real dishes. And then they installed gardens. They installed a rooftop garden into their new mission office just a few months ago, lugging like 7 feet of soil from the street that Bay Localized folks had dumped there at, you know, at 7 a.m. But with those folks and others lugging stuff up, you know, dirt up and down the three levels of stairs. And together with their members and staff and other allies worked to install this beautiful garden up on the roofs, transforming their space and their own consciousness, right, in the process. But bigger than that, or and then a step beyond that, I think, in addition, in terms of resistance, right, they've shifted from solely fighting dirty development projects in the Bayview Hunters Point to actually reaching out and entering into an agreement with the San Francisco Unified School District, which they found is actually the largest landholder in the city of San Francisco, to utilize underutilized schoolyards to create gardens and community markets, bartering spaces, farmers markets, the kinds of spaces that we might imagine as sort of liberated zones, right? Places where communities can reclaim the commons, right? This is an example of local living participatory economies where people can start to experience what a transformation could look like. We're also working in the city of Oakland with the coalition called the Oakland Climate Action Coalition, which maybe I can say more about in question and answer, but where we're again trying to proactively provide kind of policy and infrastructure visions for the city of Oakland to support so that communities can be building their local food systems and water systems and sort of, again, gain the resources to transform their neighborhoods, our neighborhoods, into ones which in which we can actually win a just transition in this period. So structurally, we're a group of six planning committee members, we're all parents. We each have sort of 1 to 3 decades of experience working as organizers and activists with a movement building agenda. We have 3 of us of those 6 are paid staff. That equals probably about 2 full-time equivalents. So there's a lot of volunteer time that's put in to growing the not just growing the organization, but to doing a lot of different work that goes into it, including 2 people, one of whom many of y'all met, Gopal, a couple weeks ago, I think, spoke to you, that provide 10 to 15 at least like hours of unpaid work per week, and are representing the organization and the not just the organization, but the politics and the work, right, through our all of our relationships in different spaces. So we're also, well, we see this as critical, right, because we understand that the network, that the revolution is not going to be funded, right? And so, clearly, like, at the moment in which we feel like our work is going to be even more critical and important to hold together, we want to be able to sustain it, and so we're trying to develop a model to do that. And part of that is developing a network structure to carry out our work. So it's not just the 6 of us. We don't have any intention of trying to grow ourselves and get more staff. And, you know, we believe strongly that base building organizations should be getting the bulk of foundation funding to do the hard work that it takes day to day to build a base. But also we just believe that many sparks, right, can lead to a more powerful flame than one kind of big but contained flame. So we've started with a trainers network. So we now have a network of folks that have come through Movement Generation Retreats and training for trainers program, and are now volunteering to provide trainings to other organizations across the Bay and increasingly across the country. And then, lastly, just in terms of the culture of our work, then I think 2 things I wanted to say. One is that we work to be kind of solution-oriented and hope-based. So not sort of take back the land or go backwards, not a back to the land movement, right? But a take back the land movement. Learning with and from indigenous and lands-based peoples, ways of knowing, that includes, you know, the elders and new immigrants that are all around us. That's learning from the laws of nature, right? So symbiosis, cycles, limits, balance, and zero waste. And that's informed by women of color feminism. So one frame that that has really taken root in the realm of sort of the green, an alternative way of looking at a green economy, of like creating a green economy that's an alternative to the way that green capitalism is trying to forge it, right, is this idea that we need to actually shift from looking at jobs to looking at roles. That what's really central about work is the meaning that it has in our lives. And also that true transformation is going to require work that not only fills those spiritual voids that's, you know, left by an economy that's based on individualist-oriented consumption and exploitative waged labor, but at the same time, we're going to need to build our communication and relational skills, right, as we increasingly need to like live in denser and more cooperative ways to create a world that is more ecologically sound, right, that can actually sustain us as peoples and communities. And so this calls us to shift our notions of work from green hard hats to kitchen tables, right? So roles like therapists and counselors and spiritual workers and coaches on an individual level, just to sort of heal from the oppression and exploitation, but also as organizers, facilitators, mediators, people that can help to hold us together in cooperation and community, right? Rather than chaos and conflict, which is how this could easily go down if we continue on the path and with the values that that are currently, you know, so steeped in our cultures. As well as bus drivers, farmers, gray water plumbers, repair people, right? All of these are critical roles.
Absorb the Jews of Europe We want only the best of Jewish youth to come to us. We want only the educated to enter Palestine for the purposes of increasing its culture. The other Jews will have to stay where they are and face whatever fate awaits them. These millions of Jews are dust on the wheels of history, and they may have to be blown away. We don't want them pouring into Palestine. We don't want Tel Aviv to become another low-grade ghetto. So, intense quote. And there's a long history of Zionist collaboration with Nazis that I'm not going to get into. But I think what we have to look at and what we have to struggle with is the way that elites make agreements throughout history, co-opt claims of liberation, and really just continue the repression and oppression of people by gender and class and racism. And for us, Zionism shares this in common with, Israel shares this in common with, many histories of colonialism, many histories of repressive nationalism, many histories of different kinds of fascism, and also has within it a lot of militarism, and then as such, a lot of patriarchy. So, how does IJAN do this? We are an international network, and we're seeking to challenge Zionism at the international scale of its impact. And so we look at Zionism as something that's not just about what happens in Palestine and Israel, though that's important, but that's also about how anti-Arab racism plays out in the countries that our activists live in, how Islamophobia has become a rallying cry for war and imperialism all over the world, and Zionism plays a role in this. We exist in the United States, in Canada, in different parts of Europe, in Israel. We have activists in Argentina, activists in India. And we're organized differently in different places. Our structure is based on what makes sense in that location. In some places, there's very formal chapters. In some places, there's very loose organizations. Loose organization. One of the things we struggle with is what has to be coordinated and shared, how are we stronger in our differences in different locations? So the work of Jews organizing inside of Israel, and particularly who we work with are Jews of Arab descent, is totally different than what it looks like as Jews organizing in Berkeley, California or San Francisco. But what brings us together is an uncompromising commitment to anti-Zionism. And we look at anti-Zionism within what we call a liberatory politic. And this gets to what we oppose is Zionism. There are things we have to oppose. We oppose racism. I'm anti-racist. I'm not unracist, non-racist. I'm not sure what I think about racism, but I don't like slavery. It's like I'm anti-racist. We're anti-Zionist. That doesn't mean that what our politic is just oppositional. So we're uncompromising in an anti-Zionist politic. But the vision of what we want, that informs, and as both Rachel and Michelle spoke to, it allows us to imagine what we want. Starting from a clear anti-Zionist position allows for that imagination. So we work consistent with the history of Jewish participation in international struggles and against Jewish participation in authoritarianism and capitalism. Both are true. There's not a singular Jewish history, and we're trying to build upon the history that we feel is liberatory. We're challenging the role that Zionism has played in moving Jews to the right. It has certainly happened in this country. It's happened all over Europe, where we were once a very vibrant force for socialist and communist and class struggle in this country, for civil rights and anti-racist struggle. We now find Jewish organizations colluding with Christian fundamentalists in their shared interest of Israel, with imperialist war against Iran, Iraq, Afghanistan. This is not the Jewish tradition that those of us who participate in IJAN grew up with or want to continue, or the world that we want to imagine. When we were building IJAN, we spent time with a lot of different activists, and I want to name two in particular. One is a woman, Mai Jayousi, who runs the Center for Democracy in Ramallah, a Palestinian activist. And she said to us, well, I would assume that Palestine solidarity is at the center of your work. And it's great that you're doing work on Palestine solidarity, but you don't need to be Jewish to do that. There's lots of people doing that. What I need to know from you is, why do you resist Zionism? Why is that important for your own history as Jews? And we were talking about how, and she basically said to us, I don't see how you can separate your commitment to the Palestinian struggle for liberation with your commitment to extricating Jewish history, Jewish politics, Jewish culture, Jewish spirituality from Zionism. Those two things go hand in hand. And we're figuring it out. Like, what that looks like in practice isn't simple, and it's not the same all the time, and sometimes we do it well, and sometimes we go in one direction or the other. Sometimes we get stuck in just responding to Palestine solidarity, and it's really a lot of times our Palestinian activists and comrades who will say to us, that's great, what we really need from you is an uncompromising and clear anti-Zionist Jewish perspective on this. We need you to be writing. We need you to be creating that counter-transformative narrative. What becomes possible if Zionism isn't allowed to dominate in its false claim of security and liberation? So we also met with an activist, Tikva, and she's in Palestine, and she was in Palestine and part of Zionist forces that ethnically cleansed Palestine, and then shortly after that became an anti-Zionist activist, and at like, I think she's like 82, continues her work as an anti-Zionist activist. And she pushed back on us, and she said, this isn't a solidarity struggle for me. This is a joint struggle against a Zionist state. And she's inside of Palestine, so that makes sense. And for us who are farther away, it's like we're not the grassroots of this struggle. We are not the people most impacted by this struggle in a material, daily way. Our land is not being confiscated. We are not being jailed every day. Our children are not incarcerated. We are not facing apartheid. And we have an independent struggle against Zionism. What that looks like in practice, we see that our role is to be to build an anti-Zionist Jewish point of reference and a force. And what we mean by point of reference is not an ideological line. It means that we always return to our liberation politics, anti-racist, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist, gender justice. We don't mean colonial feminism. We mean, like, what does it look like to imagine societies free of imperialism in which there are also conversations about gender justice by people living in that society? What does that look like? And that changes. Like the politic doesn't change, but who we're a point of reference to changes. Mostly, for instance, we don't engage with groups that are committed, Jewish groups that are committed to Zionism. Whether that's a more liberal Zionism, like we want peace because that's also good for Israel and secures Israel, or whether that's more authoritarian, reactionary Zionism. But things have changed. Since what happened in Gaza, a lot of organizations that were very concerned with peace for Israel have stood up and taken stronger stances in solidarity with Palestine. And that requires that we change. We don't change what we care about, we don't change our vision, but we engage differently. As people move, we engage differently. Our goals are to build power for the Palestine Solidarity Movement, to shift the debate so it's one of what we want and not just the myth of a long-standing, entrenched conflict between two people that's never resolvable. Actually, for us, shifting the debate is about producing hope. It's not a long-standing conflict. Jews and others in the region have lived in that region for a very long time together and cohabitated. Was it perfect? No. Were lots of people discriminated against in the region? Yes. Were Jews exceptional in that? No. But the hope is in understanding that Zionism and Israel are a state like other colonial states, and they can be fought and taken down like states of South Africa. The work that we do in balancing the very immediate need around Palestine solidarity with building this longer-term vision of what extricating and dismantling Zionism in Israel makes possible. Locally, our chapters tend to work on boycott, divestment, sanction, strategic defense, direct action. Our work is always informed by our points of reference, which is Palestinian and the Palestinian struggle and the Palestine solidarity movement, broader anti-racist work and anti-imperialist work. Internationally, what we keep being told and are trying to figure out ways into is that our most important role is a counter-narrative, is a transformative narrative. And whether it's through documentaries or whether it's through film series or study groups or writing or speaking, that's part of what we're looking at. And when we talk about what is it that we want, how do we as a network of Jews participate in a conversation about what we want that doesn't replicate the dynamics of Jews all over the world getting to say what happens in Palestine? And for us, it's not about imposing solutions. It's about thinking about the principles and the process upon which transformation and reconciliation is possible. And we don't mean a reconciliation between two people. It's not an equal conflict. It's a domination of a apartheid Zionist state against the Palestinian people, and it also is very racist against Jews of Arab descent. What we mean is, how do you reconcile a history of Jewish persecution, European colonialism, Christian supremacy that gave form in this moment in history in the shape of Israel? And for us, those principles are justice, equality, and security, the right to return, the right for Palestinians to return, the right of Arab Jews to return to their homelands from which they were displaced as a result of Israel, a redistribution of power and resources, no deportation, no ethnic cleansing, no apartheid. That's true now, and we would believe that would be true in the dismantling of the state of Israel. We would also not advocate for the deportation of 6 million Jews from the state of Israel, of course. Democracy, but not in capitalist Western terms, cultural, social, economic rights, and then a process that actually heals and transforms. You can't shove people together who have been living with so much violence and people who have been so oppressed with people who have been so privileged by a system and think that's going to work. And so our own challenge, and this is what I'll say in closing, is we're in a really tricky location in this struggle. And what is true is that doing this work challenges us to think about Jewish identity, Jewish culture, Jewish spirituality, but that isn't the goal. The Palestine solidarity and movement and liberation struggle can't be our goal. It can't be the goal for our work. It may be an outcome, but it's not the goal. It's not an opportunity or a vehicle for our own process. However, we have to find ways to use the power of an anti-Zionist Jewish voice without privileging it, addressing the actual emotional impact that challenging Zionism has for us internally and in our relationships with our families and our loved ones, and really think about what becomes possible for us without Zionism. Thank you.
Okay.
So I'm Chayla, and I'm going to be the final wrap-up type person. So just to start off, I wanted to get a sense, do folks know the quote, all the blacks are men, all the women are white, but some of us are brave? Some people know that quote, right? So that's actually the title of an anthology that Beverly Guy-Scheftel put together, who's a black feminist who actually doesn't really have any direct relation to Insight, but it's something it's something that I think of a lot when I think of our work and when I think of the origins of how we came to be as an organization. We think of ourselves as coming through a tradition of third world feminism and feminists of color. And a lot of us, you know that very much as being around work, the Combahee River Collective, the National Black Feminist Organization. Little known facts about those groups are that they existed very briefly. The NBFO was only around for like a couple of years before it imploded. So we build on that legacy, and it's also a really complicated legacy, particularly as we come together as women of color broadly. And that brings a whole lot of other identities. So Insight came to be in 2000, and it was really the vision of women of color who were working in anti-violence movements, and specifically anti-domestic violence movements. And especially after the DVSA was passed, the Domestic Violence Act, which was something that a lot of sort of mainstream white feminists had advocated and a lot of feminists of color had opposed because it further criminalized perpetrators of violence and built up the prison system. There was a lot of frustration in those movements. And so a conference was called that was to be a small conference initially. And what ended up happening was 4,000 folks showed up to a conference that only had the capacity for 2,000. 2,000 folks were turned away, but it became really clear that this was something that needed to be talked about, and this analysis was lacking in a lot of our movements. Particularly coming out of, you know, the 80s and Reagan, which, you know, yay, criminalizing women and building up the prison system. So you had, in the 90s especially, some really strong organizing against police brutality, but again, the face of that was very much, you know, police brutality equals black men, you know, sexual assault equals white women. And so we were trying to figure out how to bring really a gender justice analysis to that work around prisons and policing, and a racial justice analysis to that work around domestic violence and sexual assault. So, and a couple of specific examples that Andrea Ritchie talks about, who is one of our main folks who's done a lot of work around law enforcement violence against women and trans people of color. She chronicles sort of some examples specifically of how violence manifests against women of color by the state. The example of a 5-year-old black girl who was handcuffed and forcibly removed from her school in St. Petersburg, Florida. The example of an undocumented Latina woman who was sexually assaulted by a Los Angeles cop who was responding to her 911 call for help when a man was beating her in her home. The example of a black woman who plays on the DC women's football team being arrested for using the women's bathroom at a local restaurant. Or the example of a black woman who was 8 months pregnant, shot by a police officer in November 2004 with a 50,000 volt taser gun outside a school in Seattle where she was dropping her son off to school. So when I talk about Insight's analysis being inherently intersectional, these are some of the examples that if you responded to those things just as a racial justice organization, not looking at the gender element, you wouldn't be getting the full picture. And if you responded to those things just as if they were about gender violence, you wouldn't be getting the full picture either. So that's something that we very much struggle to bring to the movements we're involved in. So, and a little bit about how we're structured, Rachel mentioned. So we hold collectivism as really a central tenet of our organizing, and it is really freaking hard. And so we began as this national body of about 20 folks, most of whom were, to some extent, some folks were sort of superstars in our movement, and some weren't. And then chapters sort of began to spring up, and locally folks were saying, you know, we really are digging this analysis. We're doing some of this work. Can we do it, you know, through insight, through that name? And, you know, folks nationally were like, yeah, like, do it autonomously. We're all about the autonomy, yeah. But so what happened was we have then this complicated situation where we have a national body, we have chapters, and we have affiliates, which are organizations that stand on their own, are often nonprofits, but they're doing work that sort of matches up with Insight's analysis, but they're their own bag and would exist without us and like that. And then increasingly we're working toward having individual membership. But it makes for a situation where it's a lot of folks involved. And similarly to CR, there's movement in and out, there's differences in our politics. So when we've worked to move forward on issues, there's a real tension in terms of wanting to respond to things very quickly. Wanting to, you know, last year when things were going around that around the same time that Oscar Grant was killed, there was a woman in Richmond who was sexually assaulted for being queer, and how to bring those incidents together where you largely had a white queer mobilization happening around the sexual assault in Richmond, and you largely had folks of color mobilizing around the Oscar Grant thing. We really wanted to respond to that in a meaningful way and found that it was really tough because we didn't organizationally have a way to do that that felt accountable to everyone in the Bay Area chapter. And I think that that continues to be something that we really struggle with, and to sort of hit on and make extreme an old analogy, for people who are making the road by walking, that makes it really hard to run, right? We're like, when we want to run, we want to react, we want to respond. But because we're building our organization as we go, that's been extremely difficult. So that's something that we continue to work through as an organization. But one thing that has been really beautiful about that is, and what I really value about women of color feminism, is that it's always been very deeply pragmatic and holds this real tension of we are fighting for our lives, and also we have to do that in a way that is principled and accountable, right? And also we do that in a way that's, we call it an Insight jazzy, which is borrowing from the writing of, some of feminists of color, who wrote about that being a way to be flexible and responsive and move in the ways that need to happen at that moment. So one of the things that has come out of even the difficult collaborations we've had are our work on law enforcement violence, right? And so one of the things we did very early on was partner with Critical Resistance to write the CR Insight statement, which many of you have probably seen. We had it on really fly posters. We're really good at posters. So we did that early on to sort of really try to bring that gender justice analysis. And then when CR10 happened last year, we reconvened sort of a lot of those folks and had organizations that were primarily groups that were led by women and trans people of color to talk about where we were at. You know, how successful have we been with bringing this, you know, intersectional racial and gender justice analysis to the prison and policing movement? And some of the ways we talked about that were, we went through different systems that impacted our lives, like ICE, like the mental health system, like CPS, and talked about, well, who's a criminal according to this system? How does it criminalize them? And then how do we, knowing that our folks are being impacted simultaneously by all of these systems, how do we effectively organize to support those people? Because again, if you're just looking at CPS, if you're just looking at ICE, if you're just looking at the military, it's not the full picture of all these things that are actually bearing down on our folks. So that's something that I think has been a really kind of beautiful collaboration, and we managed to produce this toolkit, which was a lot of folks. We worked with CR on it, we worked with the Audre Lorde Project in New York on it, we worked with Young Women's Empowerment Project in Chicago on it, and essentially it was, the idea was that we collaborated with all these folks to create this toolkit for everyone who was doing this work, who was trying to stop law enforcement violence against women and trans people of color, to take the steps beyond the analysis to supporting more organizing work. And so we put together, you know, fact sheets and lessons and, you know, all like that. And another specific example, I think, of how, even with our messy, funky, trying to be collective and accountable structure, is in New Orleans, after Katrina, we had a chapter there who started a clinic. And the way that they did that was to put a call out to the national network of Insight. At that time, I was working, I was living in Philly working with the Insight chapter there, and, you know, got a call, and folks sort of came through. And it was a way that they could count on then the volunteers doing that support already being on the same page politically, already sort of being down to do the, you know, the dirty sort of less sexy stuff, like, you know, mopping the clinic, which we did. And it was a vision that was, again, sort of meeting the basic needs of healthcare in that community, and also it was about building a political vision and understanding of feminist healthcare and offering lessons and offering support, and particularly trying to be a space for the increasing numbers of undocumented women who were coming into New Orleans after the storm. So those are some concrete ways that I think we've managed to bring really our politics and our process together that have manifested really beautifully. Some of the things that we continue to work on are, we do still work on law enforcement violence and militarism, and we're working to really bring that together with not just law enforcement violence against women and trans people of color in this country, but how does that look in terms of occupation? We've always done work around Palestine, and now we're really trying to center, like, to make connections between cops in this country and the military and colonial forces, because all of those manifest very particularly on bodies of women of color. We're also doing increasingly work around media justice and, you know, figuring out how to, you know, when those things happen, like the New Jersey Four, and, like, you know, when you have simultaneously Oscar Grant and, you know, a woman raped for being queer, what happens, and how do we respond, and how do we as feminists of color really bring an analysis that's accessible? And we're increasingly moving into work around disability. And that's an area that a couple of us have been working on, but yeah. So that's some of the stuff we've been doing, and some of our kind of messy struggles and hopes for, you know, being a space that, because we've taken this long to struggle in our process and our structure, that I hope that we will ultimately survive as an organization. That sounded kind of depressing to end on, but anyway, I think we're the bomb, though. All right, that's all.
Let's give it up for all the panelists. So we want to just be real that the work that these folks are really powerfully boiling down for you all actually represents work that hundreds of people are directly involved in, that is currently impacting thousands and soon to be millions of people. That's a lot of stuff, right? Smart, strategic, deep, broad work. So given that they put out so much stuff, before we just jump right into, okay, what are your questions? We want to give folks just a few minutes to grab someone who's sitting next to you and just see what is bubbling up for you around all of the stuff you just heard. Really just a minute or two each to introduce yourself and say what's coming up, what's a question that you want to put out when we then take another few minutes after that for Q&A. So grab someone. So, for the moment, we're going to do this like taking a bunch of questions and then putting them all out to the panelists, and then they will go at it. So, who's got a question you want to throw out to folks? So, 1, 2, 3. Okay, Stacy. And Toby?
So my question is, I heard a lot of people talk about spirituality or trying to live in a different way, like you create different cultures and create more intellectual ideas. This is the power of ideas to transform, but also being really accountable to the bottom line in the material sense, not more jail, other stuff that's real material. So I guess want to know how you
Charles?
I heard many of you talk about your structural models or lack of structure or collective based organizing and authoritarian organizing. I just have a question around strategy, getting things done. In my experience, at the same time, people bring carry so much trauma and so much hurt and pain from the system. So while we're in coming sometimes to these collectives with that pain and with that hurt, and aren't being taken care of, and sometimes not, it's a struggle in the process of the group to remain anti-authoritarian and committed to those principles. And sometimes I wonder, are there other structures, alternative structures that, or lack of structures, I would say, that you all have considered or tried in order to address this hurt and pain, but also to move forward in your visions?
Anyone else sitting on a burning question you would like to add to the mix? Yeah.
I was just wondering if you all be willing to share one thing you do for yourselves to sustain and maintain yourselves. I'm sure this is part of it, too.
Yeah,
and paper.
This question is sort of mostly for Sarah, but also for everybody. And that's, what do you think white settler people in the U.S. can learn from Jewish anti-Zionist organizing in support of Palestinian liberation, and how can we work to build greater accountability from settlers on this land around the colonization of it, sort of drawing on the strength of anti-Zionist movements?
That's a good bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
Thanks, y'all. So we're going to take maybe 15 or 20 and whoever wants to jump in.
All right, I'll start.
Do it.
Damn.
Now, I'm just going to talk about whatever I want to talk about in these, if that's cool. None of the rest of them stepped up to do anything. So this is how I'm going to start. And I think by there are a lot of things that are interconnected for me in all of these questions. So it's not actually to avoid any of your questions either. In terms of sustaining and maintaining myself, I think that question for me is very much also in line with the vision of material, that tension between ideological and material stuff. And to be real, like, I do this to sustain myself, right? And if I am, and like I said, it's all trial and error, so it's like sometimes I do this great and sometimes I do this badly. But if I am practicing my politics, right, then I am holding in relationship kind of what my vision is with kind of what my material reality is, right? And those of you who know me know I'm kind of like not super into hippie, love, self-care, blah, blah. And, you know, the Bay Area has not transformed me in that way. I would still rather smoke cigarettes and drink coffee than hike or whatever. And that's also a different version of self-care, right? But I think, you know, the... but I think, you know, I guess at the risk of offending anybody, I do think it's important. I hear increasingly, and particularly among younger, and particularly among white organizers and activists, like self-care trumping everything else. And I feel like I don't want people to burn out. I don't want people to hurt themselves. I want people to be able to be in this for the long haul. And I feel like if you are doing your politics well, you're in it for the long haul. You're not caring for yourself in some other way. Like, hopefully your politics are feeding you, and you're structuring your life in such a way that your politics can feed you. And for me, really, that is this kind of way of moving forward toward, and again, trial and error, moving forward towards some kind of balance between ideology and practice, and understanding that sometimes there are moments that take us acting and making sacrifices to our own best interest, and there are times for reflection and, you know, tending to ourselves and whatever, but that they're all of a piece and they're not separate. And I think, you know, that kind of collective struggle that I think both Chela and I talked about also is part of that. It's part of like why we are structured in the way that we are structured is about tending to ourselves collectively, about not creating opportunities to get isolated and segmented, but it's also about a space to practice and to create the material conditions that are going to lead us toward our own liberation. So that's a start. What you got? Who's next?
Thank you for that.
Go for it.
So those are a lot of good questions. Y'all are really working hard. I think the first thing around white working class as foot soldiers, like I think around the ecological justice arena, I think it's a super important point. And so what I would say to that is, yes, like definitely we need more folks that are rooted in white working class communities that are organizing within those communities to challenge this dominant narrative of that this is like our land to control and dominate, when actually the white working class is being hurt by that whole framework as well, right? In different ways, right? I think some of the ways to do that are to foreground the frontline community struggles and the work that folks are doing in, you know, in the mountaintop removal struggles in particular, folks that are doing work in Kentucky and, you know, all around the Appalachian region, foregrounding those struggles can really be sort of a challenge to what we've seen, you know, even over these past few months, right, with the right wing creating this narrative of they're taking our country, right? That's the way the narrative is being framed. And if we can put some like anti-racist white working class movements, you know, that are on the front lines of this fossil fuel based, you know, and corporate, increasingly globalized, right, system, they're on the front lines of that struggle forward, then we can help to shift that narrative. So that's one thing. I think, so for me, so somebody back here asked, like, what do you do to sustain yourself? For me, like, one of the things that's been most important in my work is as a parent. So I have two children, two small children under five. And what's helped me to stay alive in this work and alive in a, like, not like just barely making it, but like really vibrant and full of energy every day, because it's like it's the critical work to be done, is that my kids get to be in the spaces that I'm in. Like when we go and do a retreat up at Occidental Arts and Ecology in Sonoma, it's this beautiful place with delicious food and great people all around us, and my kids are there hanging out like with some loving childcare person or their other parent, you know, to and I get to see them, you know, and like they're in the space and they transform the space as well. And then throughout the week, like my work, so I'm only paid for 15 hours a week of my work, and that's enough to, in the formation that we have right now, to sustain me and my family. And so I'm able to sort of like have this fluid way of work and family and community and, you know, relationship building with other folks in the movement. So I think that the more that we can start to see our like multiple, like wear those multiple hats, and sometimes, you know, not to say that that's always easy. Like it's definitely, I don't try to do childcare, like be the point person for my childcare when I'm speaking or when I'm like on in some way. But I think it's important that we find ways to make these spaces as like fluid and intergenerational and like allow us to hold ourselves in all of the different ways that that we are.
So, I mean, I guess to the first question, it's I actually think a lot about the ways in which folks are always encouraged to collude, right? So white working class folks colluding in sort of environmental racism, and, you know, aren't we all colluding in someone else's oppression? And I think that in Insight, because we are an organization of women of color, it's been actually fascinating to be challenged around the ways in which, you know, I, as someone who was raised middle class, have colluded in the oppression of working class people, right? I, as someone who is, I'm a light-skinned woman of color, I'm colluding in colorism. You know, as a non-trans woman, colluding in the oppression of trans people. So, I think that that sort of, by the nature of us being intersectional, it's actually given me a great opportunity to think and struggle around what it means to be an ally to folks who I identify with and who I share a lot of identity with. But there's certainly elements of their oppression that I don't share. So, I mean, I think the specific question is super important, and I also think that, you know, that's always a question for all of us in any movement. And the tension between the ideological and the material, that's something that I think has come up for us in Insight in huge ways. You know, we've had lots of fights around what do we do when it really is, it's a matter of our lives, right? And if we can lessen for just one second the boot on the neck, like, why wouldn't we do that? But what does it mean to take a small concession? And, you know, we particularly have had a lot of struggles in around around reproductive justice, and you know, when the HPV vaccine first came out, and you know, the first place they started doing the HPV vaccine was what? Public schools in DC. You know, I think there's lots of black children there, probably. So, and that was a real tension in our organization. You know, do we support this, you know, potentially this vaccine that potentially is protecting people? We don't know what it is. It's kind of new, but it seems really shady where they're, you know, where they're first putting it out. You know, similarly in the clinic, struggles around, you know, women asking for depo, and part of our analysis is that depo is part of a legacy of really restricting the reproductive rights of women of color particularly. And so, yeah, I mean, we've struggled around that, and we didn't really entirely find answers to that. I mean, the clinic ultimately does not offer depo. But I think that that's a real tension for us as an organization that we don't, you know, it's like our first couple of years, we did a lot of, you know, books and analysis and got a reputation, I think, as like big heads, like intellectual types, and which we're, you know, we're like, we're organizers too. But, and I think that that kind of tension though was the real thing was, you know, what are our ideals, but then what are we going to be doing on the ground around these issues? And it's something we really continue to struggle with. And I know CR really struggles with, in terms of that, around prison. So again, I guess not an answer, but sharing some of our struggles and thoughts around that. And then I guess just a small thing on the collective tip. I didn't mean to make us sound so dysfunctional. We're cool. We do have a system in which we have a national collective. People serve a term of 3 years, basically, and then transition off. And the idea is you're brought in with a cohort of a couple other new folks and then some older folks who are holding institutional memory. And you get sort of a training, and then, you know, you're brought in, and then folks transition off. And, so there's a continual inflow and outflow from the chapters, and generally folks are being nominated from chapters and affiliates. So the structure, I actually think, is fairly functional, and it does help tremendously with sustainability. Because, you know, I've been involved with Insight for 5 years, but I've been involved in really different ways. I was a member of the Philly chapter, I was a member of the Bay chapter, then I was a member of the Bay chapter and on the National Collective, and now I've stepped back from the local chapter and I'm just on the National Collective. But that really allows for some sustainability, that folks step back and step forward at various points and have different ways to participate in the organization. I just want to put that out, that I think that our struggles around collectivity have been real, but we've made some huge progress on that. And I think that as a feminist organization, we're really committed to trying to figure out taking care of folks when they need to be taken care of, and also encouraging folks to step back when they can't, you know, participate fully in the collective. And, you know, not that we're kicking you out, we love you, and because we love you, step back. You know, we'll see you again in a year when your life is more chill. Okay. So, anyway, that's how we think about some of that stuff.
Okay, so I think I'll start with the ideological and the material question. I want to just give an example. Like, on January 27th is the United Nations Day of Remembrance of the Holocaust. It focuses exclusively on the Nazi genocide of Jews, not other people killed in the Holocaust, nor does it focus on other experiences of genocide. So our ideological campaign is to challenge that exceptionalism. And we do that both by connecting it to current and historic, other current and historic experiences of genocide and ethnic cleansing, and specifically by looking at what's happening in Palestine and challenging the justification of what's happening in Palestine as a result of the Nazi genocide. That's important for us long term because it actually not only exceptionalizes and is used as justification, it isolates our struggle from other people's struggles historically. But materially, we hope that conversation leads to relationships of joint struggle. So we're doing a big tour in Europe with an 85-year-old survivor of Auschwitz around this politic. And we're hoping that leads to conversations about what's happening in Europe right now and how Zionism plays a role in Islamophobia and campaigns about Islamophobia. So there's a relationship between the two. Our ideology shapes our material, like what we try to change, and as we change things, it changes our ideas of how we do the work. So just that, both are totally necessary. We are also, like other people, not anti-intellectual and feel like ideas are important, as are our brains, as a way of understanding the world. Thing around white working class, I just want to answer slightly differently. I totally agree with what Michelle said. In a system of power, you always have middlemen. You always do. You have people in the middle who are colluding and who, for the illusion of certain kinds of privilege, are actually gaining certain kinds of privilege in the short term, and against their own long-term self-interest, play these roles. And I want to talk about that from a Jewish location, because Jews have played this role incredibly well throughout history. And it's been a safety strategy, but it's also been a way of accessing privilege. And some examples are in Rome. Jews were part of the court system, for instance, even though they were repressed by the Roman government. In Morocco, Jews played a very significant role between the colonial regimes. Arab Jews played a role between the colonial regimes and the colonial population. The State of Israel, you know, in the UK during the miners' strike, there was a book just written on this, and the guy who went in for Thatcher and busted and tore apart the unions is called the Jew. And it was the first time the Tory party, the Conservative Party, opened itself to Jews. And it did that because there was a useful role for them to play. And then it fuels the role that Jews have played and then eventually gotten targeted around. And Israel's doing this on a state level. They are completely in the middle of the most serious imperialist struggle in the world around the Middle East, Southwest Asia, North Africa. So it's a system of power, and it's like, how do we create a politic that's compelling enough that people will struggle for their long-term collective self-interest and struggle rather than their short-term privilege or illusion of it? And then just quickly on the, I mean, I think that's similar to the white settler people. It's like, how many people are benefiting? What are people willing to give up? Because you'll have to give something up. And then what do you gain? And how do we create the narrative so people get what they gain when you're in the middle of everything that tells you there's nothing to gain, just buy more shit and you'll feel better and you don't have to think about what you're not getting and how alienated we are, which gets to the self-care thing that, thank you. It's like, actually what I want is structural change. I don't want to have to take care of myself just by myself. I don't want to have to work my ass off for a different world that I can't live in unless I try to change. I actually want structures to change that will support us in living differently. And until we're there, we have to do it for ourselves. And to me, the meaning of the word comrade is, I need to be doing this with other people to even have space in a world that tells me nothing I think is right, everything I think is wrong. What I see as reality is so different than what we're told is reality, and that's hard, and it produces a lot of self-doubt and a lot of defeat and a lot of hopelessness. So for me, self-care is how do we struggle together in authentic ways to change the world, and how do we, yes, take care of each other in doing that. And then last thing on structure is, I think everyone who does this work is anti-authoritarian. We are anti-authoritarian against ourselves all the time. We're anti-authoritarian against, like, the teller at the bank. I mean, it's like our political culture. But I think there's, like, some distinctions. So two things on that. Not being anti-leadership, your own or other people's. And there's room for lots of leadership. And their structure, like just practically, we're an international network. Not everyone in 20 cities can know everything that's happening all the time, but what we're learning, and sometimes we do it well and sometimes we suck at it, is that we're accountable to Palestinian liberation struggle, and we're also accountable internally. And if we're not good at being accountable internally, we can't be good at being accountable externally. And we're figuring it out. So it's hard. And then I just think accountability is super important in the questions raised about accountability. So I'll stop there.
So we're going to have to wrap up this panel, but just got a last comment.
Books for sale over there. And this too, if you want. Okay. $20.
Yeah, and we're gonna hear more about the part two as well. But just thinking about what Michelle was describing, the generation's work as being this, it's solutions oriented and hope based, which I think also is to me a really good description of all the work that folks have been talking about. But it's so hopeful to be coming together and having spaces like this. So we also want to really appreciate you all for being here and part of this, and for the work that you're all doing in your own lives and communities. And also this piece of being able to learn from each other, and that this is part of what it means to have what Sarah was just naming of this collective struggle for our liberation. So it's been really wonderful to be here with you all, and let's give it up for our amazing panelists.